Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
For many of us, our first introduction to a musical is through its cast recording, and if the show has closed after you discovered it, then the only way we know the show is through its album. The need to capture the show's energy and impact is a major responsibility for the person that's tasked with preserving that show on record. It becomes definitive. And as the founder of Ghostlight Records, today's guest has done just that for the past 20 years.
His legacy of albums includes The Last 5 Years, In the Heights, Be More Chill, Things to Ruin, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Beautiful, Beetlejuice Next to Normal, Natasha Pierre, Newsies, Spelling Bee, The Drowsy Chaperone, and most recently, Broadway Bounty Hunter, Prince of Egypt, and Soft Power, Janine Tesori, hello.
So if you got like a BFA in the past 20 years, like you know, you owe your career to this man. To tell us what it was like to work with such folks as Sherry Renee Scott, Joe Iconis, Bill Finn, and so many more, here is Grammy Award winner, Kurt Deutsch. So Kurt, first question for you, which is, when you were growing up, and you were enamored with the arts, did you ever think in a million years that you were going to end up being one of the most successful producers in the music industry?
Of recordings, no. It was the farthest thing from my mind. It was I grew up in St. Louis, mm-hmm. and my mom would take me to the Muni every Tuesday, she had season tickets, and so that's kind of when I fell in love with musical theater. And I really wanted to be an actor first and a performer. So I would literally sit in my, bedroom with my record player and just, you know, my best friend was my mirror and I would like act, you know, all the cast albums out.
Cast album got worn out the most in this private performance?
Well, I mean, it was like, you know, it was stages, right? So like very, very early on, it was my parents, you know, what they listened to. So it was things like West Side Story and Fiddler on the Roof and you know, My Fair Lady and those kinds of things. And then a little bit later, it turned into Chorus Line. But then I think that probably Pippin was the one that probably biggest influence, you know, because it was also one of the ones that had a video, so I put it on VHS and
of course
watched the video of Ben Vereen I think for my Sunday school confirmation I actually quoted in my speech the lyrics "The Corner of the Sky." Because that's what musical theater nerds do.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, but
the
then
wise words.
The thing that's amazing about it all is that, you know, now I get to work with Stephen Schwartz, and you know, we just put out the Prince of Egypt album and the revival of Pippin and Godspell and About to Be Rags. So it's like, you know, you get to work with your heroes, which is kind of amazing.
Do you still have hero worship when these people walk into the room and go, "Kurt, help me"?
Well, they don't usually say help me. They usually say collaborate. I collaborate with them, but
like yeah,
of course I do. I mean, because they were hugely, I mean, when I was in college, I remember, you know, a big show for me was Falsetto, you know, March of the Falsettos in Falsetto Land, and getting to work with Bill Finn a number of times, because he really, I mean, as far as modern musical, you know, and huge, and then to be able to do Spelling Bee and and then the revival of Falsettos and one of his, and he was a huge influence and such a character. And Alan Menken, one of the first shows I saw in New York was the original cast of Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh my gosh, you got a ticket.
I was in eighth grade. I was in 10th grade. And so I saw, I saw the original cast there, and that was, you know, life changing, that show for me. You know, and getting to work with Alan Menken and on a number of projects has been incredible.
Where was college for you, Kurt?
I went to Syracuse University for 2.5 years, and then I went to the O'Neill Theater Center. They have this thing called the National Theater Institute, and that was like a semester. And so that was my junior year. Instead of like going to London, I went to the O'Neill, and then I got an agent from the O'Neill, and I convinced my dad to let me. To let me move to New York after that semester. Jeez. And he basically said, okay, if you don't make it in 6 months, you have to go back to school. So I didn't make it. But the last day that I was to go back to college, I auditioned for a play called Broadway Bound, which is a Neil Simon play. And then I went to college, and then 8 weeks into the semester, I got a call back for it because you know, the actor Evan Handler.
Yes. Yeah. Great actor.
Evan, at the time, and this was in 1987, maybe 87, I think he had come down with leukemia, and it was horrible, and they needed somebody to replace very fast. And so I was able to come down. I auditioned on the Broadhurst stage. Oh. And then they basically said, how fast can you move down to New York? And so I dropped out of college. I moved in with my girlfriend at the time's parents at 96 McDougal Street in the Village. And then I started out understudying and then I ultimately took over the role and did it for about a year and a half. So that was kind of my college story, you know.
Was that your first did you have your union card already? I mean, did you join the union with this audition as well? I mean, had you worked professionally before?
I did summer stock. So my summers would be in Ohio, like in Kenyon Festival Theater in Ohio, and I did something in Keene, New Hampshire, and I did something in Maine. And then I went to the Edinburgh Festival. So I don't remember. I think I had my equity card from summer stock. But it was definitely my first, you know, Broadway thing.
That's a big thing. And you got it in college.
I was very, very fortunate. I was very lucky, you know, it was incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
And then after Broadway Bound, A Few Good Men, is that correct?
After Broadway Bound, I did a couple of off-Broadway shows, and one of them was an Aaron Sorkin play called Making Movies that was like, you know, ran 32 performances at the Promenade Theater. Yeah. And that's when I met Aaron. And Aaron also went to Syracuse, so we have that in common. But because of that, I ended up in A Few Good Men. Yeah. And then I did that for about nine or 10 months, I think. Mm. And then I moved out to LA.
And why the move to Los Angeles?
Because my agent said that I should do television. And so I was like, you know, they basically said that. And so I got a TV series, pretty fast, with John Mahoney, called The Human Factor, which was it's always like the year before, like I was always on these TV shows the year before something happened. So this was like the year before ER, you know, I was on this medical show the year before ER, and our show was like, you know, and I played like the Noah Wiley character, the, you know, the young, you know, doctor, and, you know, so, totally. I call myself the year before act. I would do a pilot every year, and then the next year, that same kind of series would end up being like the great series that I didn't do. You know,
of course,
what I
mean? Of course,
of course.
What was it like working with John Mahoney?
John Mahoney, he was just so easy and natural and professional and just and gracious and generous. He's an amazing, amazing actor, you know, and he had that kind of career where, you know, he had a life prior to acting, you know, he didn't really, you know, he was a member of Steppenwolf and he was an amazing actor, really amazing actor.
So you're out in Los Angeles, and when does this idea start to come to you of, hey, maybe moving into a different career field might be either an interesting thing or a necessary thing?
It wasn't necessary at all. It was just, it was actually when I was in LA, I did, I did a lot of bad television and, but I had a great theater company that was kind of my lifeblood. I was in a theater company called the Matrix Theater Company and it was on Melrose. And so the interesting kind of thing about this particular theater company was that every show was double cast. Mm-hmm. So there would be two casts of people and we would never, you never knew who you were going to be playing. It wasn't like an A cast and a B cast. It was like we would mix it up so that the casts were different. And so I did The Seagull with Jeffrey Tambor and Sharon Lawrence and Penny Fuller and Richard. That's how I met Richard Kind, who's one of my best friends. And
oh my gosh.
And Richard. Anna Gunn was my Nina. And, you know, so it was like, it was crazy, a crazy talented group of people because everybody were theater actors. We were all living in LA. We were making decent money doing television, but we all wanted to just cut our teeth doing what we love to do.
Yeah.
So that's the acting part. But then I did a play, a musical at the La Jolla Playhouse called Randy Newman's Musical Faust.
Mm-hmm.
And so I played Faust in that. And that's where I met my former wife, Sherry Renee Scott. And so we got together in 1995, August of 1995, and were married in 1998. And during that time, living in LA, still doing theater, but she got cast in Rent. So we were back and forth. And she also got cast in the Elton John's musical, the Aida. And so we moved back to New York for Aida and I did my Sex and the City and I did my Law and Order and, you know, like
the circuit kind of things.
Did a couple of independent films, but it was at that time that I was kind of feeling like, she was interested in making an album and I didn't really know anything about that part of the industry, but somebody gave her a contract that was, you know, wanted her to sing show tunes. And I looked at the contract and I was like, this doesn't make a lot of sense. The financials don't make a lot of sense. And so, I said, you know, you're playing to 15,000 people a week on Broadway. Why don't we make the album that you want to make? We'll put the money up and then maybe if we're lucky, we'll put your website in your bio and then maybe Disney will sell them in the lobby or, you know, it just kind of started like that. And, and she was very, very connected to a lot of, from doing Tommy, and Grease and other shows, she was very connected to the musical theater community in ways that I was not connected to the musical theater community. And so because of that, I got friendly with Adam Pascal and so we started thinking about this idea of creating a record label that was more of like a United Artists for the Broadway community. And it wasn't necessarily about cast albums. It was more about Sherry doing her own project, Adam Pascal doing his original music, Alice Ripley doing her songs, and the Broadway Inspirational Voices, which was then called the Broadway Gospel Choir, wanting to work with them. And so it started that way, and then eventually we got into cast albums.
How did you know what to do?
I read a book called Everything You Want to Know About the Music Business by a guy named Don Passman.
Awesome.
And it was kind of like I read every book that I could possibly read. When the idea of a record producer, I was a directing major at college as well. So I have an acting and directing background. So I was able to communicate. My expertise is not in, I'm not an engineer. I'm not, technically proficient in terms of mixing
equipment,
kinds of things. But what I bring to the table, I think, is the ability to speak to an actor, the ability to hear things, the ability to kind of feel, to how do you get a song across from a from an aural perspective, a listening perspective, as opposed to when you're seeing it on stage.
And how do you do that? What do you look for? Or what note do you find yourself giving the most in the recording session?
I think that the biggest note, because the thing that's great about cast albums is that you try to capture the energy of a live performance, but you need to encapsulate it. Your audience is your microphone to a certain degree. And so you want to be able to kind of get to the truth through, cause you don't have anything else hiding you. So it's not like you can rely on that comic bit that is a physical bit. It's all about how do you encapsulate your performance for a listener as opposed to what they're seeing. And so a lot of the times it's about how are you communicating? Are you projecting too much? You don't need to project that much. Can you get the same intensity across in a different way, yet still get the same emotional resonance?
Which show have you worked on that has been the most challenging in terms of taking the brilliance that are on stage and then, putting it out into a recording? I'm sure they're all challenging, but which one did you find, oh my gosh, this is a tough one?
Well, it was more, I guess, you think about it a lot of different ways. I think of how do you do certain things to be able to capture what the energy is on stage. So I think of a show like Passing Strange, where, going in and recording it in a studio would have been the wrong way to do it. And so we did it live in front of an audience, but we wanted to recreate. It wasn't like a live capture. We actually made a recording studio and invited people into into the process. And that presented its own challenges in general. A show like another challenging one was Hair, the revival of Hair, because it is so communal and everybody sings on almost every song. And so it was a challenge recording it, because you have to give your all in that. Those actors were performing at such a peak level and it was the only time that I think that we've done it where we actually started at the beginning of the show and then went through it. And also because of the size of the cast, recording studios have been a challenge, because all the recording studios have been closing. And so we actually had people in three or four or five different rooms, and we did it live, but we had everybody all over the place, and we would start losing, like Will Swenson lost his voice in the middle of the recording. And, you know, so there's certain, you know, certain things that ended up happening where it presents challenges, but it ultimately, I mean, worked out. We, you know,
great album back
when, yeah. Oh my God. I mean, yeah.
The energy is exciting. Yeah.
So you had originally had started out just for your label, if I'm understanding this correctly. It was mostly intended for solo artists that were working on Broadway.
Shikaboom, right? Yeah.
Yeah, to have. Yeah,
so Shikaboom. So Shikaboom was like the idea. It was like Sherry was the SH and K was me, and then Kurt, and then Boom ended up. I don't know. So
it's a great name.
That's kind of how that started. And then when we started getting more, and that was about artists who wanted to bridge the gap between rock and roll and theater. That was kind of the idea. And we would do these midnight concerts on Thursdays at a place called the Cutting Room. And then we started doing bigger concerts at the Village Theater, which is now Le Poisson Rouge in New York.
Yeah.
And so we did these bigger concerts and like we did the first reading of what is now Next to Normal.
Awesome.
We had people like Idina Menzel and Gavin DeGraw on a double bill. It was a way for the Broadway community late night on Thursday nights and the theater community to come together. This was all like, this is our 20 year anniversary. So this is all like,
yes,
2001, 2000, you know, so that it was kind of those 2 years,
yeah,
pre 9/11.
Happy anniversary, yeah, by the
and
way,
really,
20 years.
Congratulations. And really, you were very, very much ahead of the, you know, now we have pop rock all the time on Broadway. Right. But that's when I was in college, and we didn't have pop rock like the way we do now. I mean, now it's really kind of interesting that you caught that wave. Right,
yeah. Well, I think Rent and, yeah, Tommy were the shows that, you know, Rent was kind of one of those defining moments in everybody where it was about, you know, and we just did the Jonathan Larson project, but that was ahead of its time. It was also kind of the first show, I think, that defined the internet movement where you were able to reach beyond the typical Broadway community. And now, 20 years later, you see that fan engagement globally for musicals in a much different way. So, but yeah, we were building it back then, trying to build a community, this art, these group of artists, and then we started getting into cast albums
with Ghostlight.
Yeah. Ghostlight started a few years later and that really was because Shikaboom is kind of a stupid name, but also, it was limiting because I would say, you know, somebody would say to me, I have this really great, beautiful album, but it doesn't necessarily fit within our model of bridging the gap between rock and roll and theater. So to do an album with Patti LuPone, right, is not really, you know, I mean, is not really part of that unless it was like, you know, Patti does Nirvana or something like that. But
I'd buy that.
Yeah, exactly.
But
I think one of our first albums was the Michel Legrand Amour. And
yes.
So Amour didn't really fit into that world. So, and there was the idea of creating a new imprint, which is Ghostlight, was important to be able to kind of broaden the audience and to be more inclusive.
Even at the time, I remember I would buy every single Ghostlight record possible, but I remember thinking, this is amazing you were able to do that when the record labels were doing the opposite, right? At this time period, it was not a hot thing to have a cast album and to be making it like it is now, I think. And so, yeah. I mean, a little more so now. I'm curious how you, and we don't have to know financials, but I'm curious how you made it work. I mean, how did you create a new way of financial, or, you know, trying to make money on this? Can you speak a little bit about that?
I mean, I'm not a not-for-profit, but the idea was, it was pretty simple in that I thought, I was thinking like, you know, at the time record label, you know, Broadway producers would be raising $10 to $12 million, however much it costs to make a musical.
Right.
And they would typically give away the cast album rights to a record label to pay for the entire thing. So I didn't, and that contract that they gave Sherry was the same contract that they were giving to a Broadway show. And I couldn't believe that after reading my Don Passman book, the Everything You Want to Know About the Music, you know, the music business. I couldn't believe that shows would give away one of their biggest assets, not only for marketing, but also financial. And so the last 5 years was, I think, probably the first cast album that we did. And it was a small show. Sherry was starring in it with Norbert, and Marty Bell and Ariel Tepper were the producers. And it was after 9/11. The show got kind of lukewarm reviews. It was a ghost town down in the village. But I said, I knew that this show, to me, was kind of like a mini masterpiece. And I said to the producers, I said, why don't we just finance this together? We'll own it together.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And we'll do a joint venture. And so I put half the money in, they put half the money in, and, you know, in the last 5 years has, you know, lived on. I think not a lot of people got to see the show live with Norbert and Sherry, but right. The cast album, you know, exists in a way. Definitely. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you saw the Ariana Grande did a cover last
night.
It was incredible. So, and then from that, I ended up producing the movie with Anna Kendrick and blah, 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 blah. But,
yeah.
But that's kind of the genesis of the business model is essentially joint ventures with the Broadway producers.
Sure. If you didn't step forward for that, do you think anyone would have recorded this? Do you think anyone would have come forward and been like, oh, let's record this show?
I would hope that somebody would have, but nobody had at the time.
And if you don't mind my asking, because we're interested in, you know, the history of things, which is, if you don't mind sharing, how much did it cost to produce that album versus how much would it have cost today if you were doing the same thing?
Well, I'll give you a range. So
yeah, that's
so
yeah.
Typically a small show like that will go somewhere between $75,000 or higher, you know, to a larger Broadway show can be much more expensive in the $300,000 to $400,000 to $500,000 range. But you know, in the last 5 years on the smaller side, I think it was probably, I want to say it was maybe $90,000 to make that album, something like that.
How much do you have to sell in order to, in order to break even?
Well, back then,
yeah,
you know, you're talking about a much more physical
mm-hmm.
market. You know, iTunes didn't really exist back then in 2000. I don't remember how old iTunes is, but that was selling much more physical product. You know, and now things are very, very different where it's, right. You know, pretty much we're selling hardly any physical and it's mostly digital and and pretty much mostly streaming at this point. Mm-hmm. So it varies, you know, for a 90, you know, at that time, you know, you figure you see roughly $6 or $5 or $6 an album at that time. So whatever that, I'm really bad at math.
No, that is, but we all are. It's okay.
This is Lucille. Do you want to help keep Broadway Behind the Curtain on the air? Head over to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. And search Behind the Curtain, Broadway's living legends, and set a monthly donation. Even a dollar. Just tell them, here you come, pow, pow. Light the candles. Get the ice out. I'm going to sing until you give. Roll the rug up. Give today at Patreon.
Now that you have, you know, you've created this great legacy of some of the most iconic, influential musicals for people over the past 20 years, you've been able to preserve that. What do you know now that you wished you had known then when you started producing these things? If you could go back and talk to yourself 20 years ago, you would say, hey, don't worry about this, or hey, make sure you pay attention to that.
I mean, I think I spent too much money at the beginning, just because I didn't know. But also because of what's going on right now, and especially in self-isolation and all those kinds of things, it's like, how do you keep up? I've not been one to not I tend to take a lot of risks. And so I, you know, when streaming started happening, I was the first one to say, okay, this is the future. We have to go to it. This is, you know, and so a lot of people are scared of technology and scared of what that does to the business and all that kind of stuff. I've been more of a person who embraces that a little bit more and feel like it's only going to make the audience wider and them wanting to see the show. But so I think that if anything, it's trying to be as open as I can and not as close-minded at the time and not being as stubborn, you know?
Yeah. And I what I find so interesting is, you know, like you were saying earlier on, you know, you had asked Sherry's, you know, website to be in the liner notes. That was really ahead because nobody, I think, was really doing that at the time.
Yeah.
No, and I mean the types of, you know, shows that we were looking to record. What do you think the next 10 years or so might be holding for the original cast recording industry? Is there a thing that you think, oh, this might turn out to be a trend, or this might be some way that the field is moving?
I'm trying to think about the next year, you know what I mean? Yeah. what's going to happen in the next year as opposed to 10 years? But it's like, what is going to be the disruptor, you know, which you think about, you know, in 10 years, we're probably not going to be driving cars. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like everybody's going to be, you know, we're not going to have automobiles. I mean, if you would have told me that 10 years ago, you know, there would be no CDs, there'd be no, you know, it's all digital, it's all subscription based. I mean, I think that's why these records are doing so well, or a lot of them are doing so well, is because the audience is now, you know, it's instantaneous and it's global and everybody can connect. I think that's going to keep happening. But I think how we consume music, I don't know what's going to happen beyond streaming. I think gaming is a huge part of it. I think that you're seeing now TikTok and YouTube and, you know, Voisey, all these different apps that people are using to create music. I think that's going to keep expanding. And it's all about subscription-based and subscriber-based now, because you are seeing real money from those subscribers. Like at the beginning with Spotify, they would say, oh, you're only seeing this little amount, you know, per stream or whatever. But it really does add up, because everybody's subscribing to... They're now subscribing to YouTube. They're now subscribing to Spotify. They're subscribing to Apple Music. They're subscribing to Google Play. There's so many different places in which people are subscribing to, and the numbers are growing by the millions. 4 years ago, there was not very many subscribers. Now there are.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody is a subscriber to something. And, and that actually is a very different kind of commerce than selling one physical CD and then you're done. Every time somebody plays a cast album or a stream or whatever they're doing, you're monetizing that. So it's living in a cloud. You're not having to manufacture. You're not having to do those things. You're constantly in catalog, you know, these shows, which is great, is that there's only going to be one original cast album of the Book of Mormon. You know, there's only going to be one original cast album of the last 5 years. And so, you know, people still listen to the original cast albums of West Side Story or Company or any of these shows. So I think that's the beauty of the cast album. People don't necessarily listen to just one song. They listen to whole records.
Yeah. Right.
Which is kind of a difference. But I do think that things need to change in terms of the economics. It shouldn't cost as much as it does cost, because we're not in the days where albums are selling millions and millions of copies, you know, like when the contracts were negotiated and the producers are having to bear a lot of the brunt. And most cast albums, I would say, are not necessarily profitable. I look at things as preservation projects, and I look at things as financial and commercial projects. And so, you know, I take a deep responsibility in the preservation part of it.
Yes.
But I'm not a not-for-profit. So a lot of it has to be, you know, angel investors and those kinds of things.
How do you pick, because that's an artistic sort of opinion that you have to have. And what is your sort of litmus test? How do you decide? Because I imagine you get a lot of people saying, hey, will you record my show? It's really good. And how do you, other than good old-fashioned, like, I like that art, I don't like that art, is there some sort of other test?
You know, no. Really.
I mean, I like your aesthetic, I always have, and I always will. But certain things that I
feel will be profitable, and certain things that I feel will not be profitable. And you know, and I've been right, and I've been wrong a lot of times. But at the end of the day, my goal is, if you want to make an album, I'll help you make the album. It's just, I'm not necessarily going to pay for your album.
Mm. Yeah.
So you have some albums that, because I'm a layman here. Mm-hmm. You have some albums that you put up the money. Then you have some albums that if someone says, hey, I really like Ghostlight, I want that label, but I'm a millionaire. You will do that then as well. Or will you still say, I still need to make sure that we want our name on this?
Yeah. I think that there's a few different ways that I work. It's more about, it's relationships, it's financial, you know, joint ventures. It's also like preservation. I want to make sure that these albums get preserved, and let's figure out a way in which you can get the money, even though it's not necessarily about making money, you know, and because a lot of people benefit from it, not just me. It's more about the future student. It's about, okay, the licensing company, MTI or you know, one of these licensing companies, you know, need a cast album in order to license their show, because without a cast album, most shows will not be licensed. Right. So it's working with the licensing companies, working with the producers of the show. If it's a not-for-profit, working very closely with the not-for-profit, who have a lot of times you know, recording grants or things like that they'll use. So I work, but if it's a commercial, if it's a big Broadway show that I feel is commercially viable, like Beetlejuice or something like that, I'll put money into it.
Early on in the process do you get involved? Like for something like Soft Power, for example, do you see it and go, oh, this is fantastic, let me see if I can record this? Or do they approach you? Well, let's take Soft Power as an example, please, which is fantastic, by the way. Thank you so much for making that happen.
Soft Power was actually very, very late, actually. I kind of came in at the last minute, and they called me and they said, because they weren't sure if they were going to make the album, and so they called me at the last minute and said, hey, could you do this for us? And so we did.
So that's a them approaching you type thing. How does this process normally work? Do they pitch the shows to you even before they get into rehearsals? Do they invite you? How does the mating dance?
I go to a lot of I have my record label, but I also work at Warner Chappell Music Publishing.
Yes.
Congratulations on that.
From the theater, kind of the theater division there. And so I go to a lot of readings. I go to a lot of shows, and then I have relationships with a lot of the producers and not for profits.
But it's not like one of those things where other people are trying to outbid one another, or is it? It is with okay. I can offer you this, I can offer you that. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have such a great relationship with Joe Iconis, because I mean, who is transforming the way people are finding musical theater, which is so cool, but also such a responsibility, I'm assuming, for you, because this is the conduit for so many listeners. How did your relationship with Joe develop? And talk a little bit, please, about Broadway Bounty Hunter with the incredible Annie Golden, who...
Well, Joe, I guess I met pretty much right after he graduated from NYU, and somebody had sent me, said, you should really meet this guy. He's kind of got an original voice. And so I met him, and he was just a very... you know, quiet,
yeah.
Introverted kind of guy. And we talked, and I told him the kinds of things that I was interested in doing. He didn't really have a lot of musicals at the time, but I just found his voice to be very, very original. And I loved a lot of his songs. And so we talked about creating I love the idea of concept albums. I love the idea of song cycles. And so we talked about that, I think. And then that's kind of how Things to Ruin spawned, where he created Things to Ruin as kind of a song cycle. And that's when the relationship really started, when we put out Things to Ruin. And then he just has been building his kind of family of musicians and artists together over the years. And then I just, you know, have been supporting him ever since. Be More Chill was another example of, you know, when I went and saw it at, Two River Theater, I said, we've got to record this thing. And so I was fortunate enough that Two River supported it and we paid, you know, and so it was like, so we recorded.
It doesn't happen a lot. A regional theater pre-Broadway, you know, usually, well, I mean.
They review in the New York Times. So I knew that show, I mean, I, you know, when you talk about Instinct, I just knew some of those songs would speak to that 12-year-old in me when I was a kid in St. Louis that I would want to sing it. I'd want to sing along to this thing. And Michael in the Bathroom ended up having, I mean, that's kind of like Beetlejuice is another example of, you know, you hear the first time I heard Sophia sing Dead Mom, I was like, okay.
Yep.
That 16-year-old girl is going to want to sing that song over and over and over again.
And they do. Yeah.
It's those are the kinds of things that I look for when I hear, especially from a commercial place, who is the audience, you know, who are buying, who are listening. If you think of Wicked, if you think of Spring Awakening, you think of those kind of Legally Blonde, those kinds of shows, it's the musical theater person or people sometimes who don't feel like they fit in or underdogs who are trying to find their place in the world. And I think that songs that resonate like that in a lot of ways are what people want to sing over and over and over and over again. So anyway, so Joe, so we did Things to Ruin. We did Be More Chill, both Be More Chill albums. And then Broadway Bounty Hunter, which was Joe's love letter to Annie Golden, you know?
Yeah. And now I want to go back for a second. You said two albums for Be More Chill. What were the differences between album one and album two?
The Off-Broadway and the Broadway. So you've got the Off-Broadway one. It's really Two Rivers.
Yeah.
The Two River one, which was done then at Two River. And then the Broadway one, which was a souped-up orchestration, different cast, a few different songs. They're just two different records. And then Broadway Bounty Hunter is for Annie, and I think that it's awesome. And Brad Oscar, who
I love, Brad Oscar,
with New Hampshire in 1985.
What?
Yeah.
What shows?
We did Candide. And Merrily We Roll Along.
Oh, nice.
The Robber Bridegroom and Baby.
That's a good season.
I'd like to get a time machine. I want to go back. Jeez. I want to see those. And then tell us a little bit about Prince of Egypt.
Prince of Egypt was, they did it. It's the London production of Prince of Egypt that is, was playing. Hopefully it'll open up again when people can
see
the theater. But again, it's just another Stephen Schwartz album that I've been fortunate enough to work with him on a number of projects. And it's, a cast of, a cast of 35 and a huge orchestra. It's a big, big show. It's similar in a lot of ways to the Hunchback of Notre Dame album that we did, but it's one of those shows that, I think he wrote five songs for the film, and now it has 23.
He's fleshed it out. Oh, that's exciting.
A lot more. And it's very, very lush. I don't think many people write melodies the way that Stephen does.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of story, which will be, I'm Jewish, and it's the story of Moses, a story of Passover, and I think people will look back on it in a way where it'll be done a lot.
What's on your bucket list of concept albums or ideas that you'd still like to have come to fruition?
We're getting ready to. I mean, I have a bunch. The things that I've been kind of most proud of lately are these projects. Like, I've been recording all of Michael Friedman's work that we have like nine albums that we're recording of his musicals, and I recorded Bloody Bloody and Fortress of Solitude and and Love's Labor's Lost, and so I love Michael and I feel like his work is, he's just so singular. And then Michael's mentor was Elizabeth Suedos. And so we've just finished recording a Liz Suedos project. Is a remarkable album.
Oh, fun!
Coming out in May. People, actually, we haven't really announced it yet, but anyway, it'll be coming out in May.
Thank you.
That's exciting.
And then I've just been developing shows, a lot of shows lately. I produced The Wrong Man, which was the Ross Moore show, and that got nominated for a bunch of Drama Desk Awards.
Yes,
and,
congratulations.
I'm working with Kevin McCullum on a musical version of The Notebook.
Ingrid Michaelson. Yeah.
So I'm doing that. And then developing a lot of things with Warner Chappell. But as far as, so I'm kind of transitioning, kind of next phase is probably
More producing.
More producing and, cast albums. And also in this time, really thinking about what is, if we can't get back into the theater for a number of more months, which it doesn't look like we're going to, how do you pivot? A lot of people are doing virtual play readings on Zoom or doing a lot of virtual concerts, but I feel like it's an opportunity now to be thinking about concept albums, to be thinking about, okay, what's the next Jesus Christ Superstar? What's the next Evita? What's the next The Wall? What's the next Tommy? What are the next concept albums that you can kind of create and put out into the world that could then generate, I'll see it in the theater one day, or I'll make
it. Yeah. Hadestown did that. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, those are the kind of things that I'm thinking about.
I think that's so wonderful that, you know, you still want to bring these stories and finding a different way of adapting them to our current situation. Mm-hmm. Our last question for you is you know, what do you hope that your legacy and Ghostlight Records legacy is going to be, you know, 100, 200 years from now?
I hope we can still go to the theater.
Yes.
And I hope that people will, you know, I mean, the idea of Ghostlight to me, you know, I mean, it's actually, especially we've seen a lot of, during the pandemic, people have been talking about the Ghostlight and how that is, you know, placed in the theater when theater is dark, but the light always shines on. And the reason that I chose the name of Ghostlight was because when the theater is dark or when the show is done, the music will always live on. Mm. And so to me, if people, I mean, it's less about me than it is more about a history and a legacy and a preservation of these scores that, you know, hopefully will live on forever and will keep educating people and will keep inspiring people. And people can dream about, like I did when I was in St. Louis, dream about, you know, being on Broadway or being an actor, being a producer, being a director, you know, whatever their dream is, to allow them to, you know, have this be a portal into that dream. So.
That's great. Kurt, on behalf of Kevin and I, but also on the millions of listeners that you've inspired through your records, we just want to say thank you so much. It really means the world to us, one, that you spend time with us today and that you keep creating dreams for people through your brilliant company. So thank you for that, Kurt.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Till next time, everybody. Stay safe.
Bye, folks.
Bye.
Today's episode was recorded at Shetler Studios on 244 West 54th Street. Visit Shetler Studios to book your room today, and you could be as cool as us. That's Shetler Studios.com.
And a big thanks to our sound editor, Daniel Schwartzberg, and social media manager, Bethany Ann Selecki.
And friends, don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you guys can come in and help us out.
Yes, in order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. The more ratings, the more they'll come up in searches. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us 1 star and make us feel as bad as Annie did in that weird production in Boston where Annie dreamed about being adopted and then ended the show back in the orphanage. True story, Rob was there.
I saw it. So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.